Coming up, does expensive healthcare mean better healthcare? Not always.
We know that more can be injurious to people, and more healthcare services, more aggressively providing those services, can result in lower levels of care.
And gospel singer Whitley Phipps on hope and amazing grace.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome. I'm Kim Lawton, sitting in for Bob Abernethy. Thank you for joining us. The Obama administration launched a new initiative this week encouraging Americans to help fight hunger in their communities. The campaign is called United We Serve, Feed a Neighbor. It urges people to donate money to local soup kitchens and food banks and also to volunteer their time and talents. The effort comes amid new government reports that hunger is on the rise in the U.S. 49 million Americans struggled to put food on the table this past year. That's an increase of 13 million. And a record number of Americans, 36 million, now receive food stamp assistance. Joining me with more on all of this is Candy Hill, a senior vice president at Catholic Charities USA. Candy, it seems like this time of year, every year, we hear appeals from groups saying, oh, people are hungry, you need to give. What makes this year different?
Well, we certainly are seeing such an increase and new people that have never come to Catholic Charities for services before. Some of them are even our donors, and some of them are our former board members. So we see a real crisis in the number of people coming and who need assistance this year over the other years that we've been in business.
And there's been some talk of food insecurity. I mean, we're not talking about people starving in the streets, but we're talking about people who are just having a harder time feeding their families.
Yes, and I think when we talk about food insecurity, we're really talking about people not having food for three meals a day. So we find parents who are scrimping or not having a meal themselves in order to feed their children, and seniors who are making choices between whether they buy medicine or feed themselves. And in a country as great as this country, we shouldn't have people doing that.
And this is a function of the economy and all of the repercussions of that?
I think this is a perfect storm. We see the economy and the people that we serve certainly were struggling before the collapse of Wall Street. But they were struggling first and will be the last to recover in this recovery.
And to what extent is it difficult in these tough economic times to make appeals for groups like yours, to say to people, give money to hungry people, when individuals might be thinking, you know, I don't know how I'm going to feed my own family?
Exactly. Well, what I would say is Americans, we've always risen to the occasion, and this is one of these occasions. Our neighbors are suffering, and we need to dig deep into our own pockets. The government has a role to play. All of us have a role to play, and we need to reach out and help each other during this really tough time.
Well, speaking of the government's role, the U.S. government is urging people to give more in this new initiative. But is that enough? I mean, is it enough for individuals to give $20, $100, or whatever? Or do we need systematic changes in policy?
Well, I think long-term we need systematic changes. But, you know, that's a long-term strategy. And right now we have a short-term problem. And so we need people to give, and we also need the government to step up and do its part as well.
Are you pleased that the administration is having this initiative?
Absolutely, because I think it highlights always when the administration speaks on something and gives information, it helps connect to the things that we're doing on the ground. And so this initiative certainly, I think, will highlight the need, but also the really creative things that are happening across America to try and meet the needs of individual people.
Yours is a faith-based organization. A lot of groups are trying to help the hungry. What is the specific role for religious groups and those from the faith community?
Well, certainly we have a 2,000-year tradition that we're supposed to feed the hungry, and we take that very seriously. And so we've been doing this for decades across the country, and we see it as a moral issue that people shouldn't have to go hungry in a country as rich as ours, and we're going to continue to try and meet the needs of people in local communities across this nation.
Again, we hear all the time, people are hungry, the poor are always with us. Are there solutions? Is it possible to end hunger?
I absolutely believe it, and certainly the government is calling on that, and Congress is as well. We have to think creatively. We have to think about 21st century solutions to 21st century problems. And the safety net in this country is badly torn and weakened, and we need to not just fix it. A repair is not sufficient. We really need to think about how do we eliminate the need for programs like food stamps and like donations to feed the hungry through a food bank or a soup kitchen. And if we have the political will in this country to do it, we can change this. You know, Bobby Kennedy 40 years ago called attention in the Mississippi Delta to children being hungry, and yet today you and I are sitting here having the same conversation four decades later. We just need to rise to the occasion and have the political will to change it.
All right. Candy Hill, thank you very much.
Thank you as well.
In other news, more people around the world are infected with the AIDS virus. According to a new report by the UN and the World Health Organization, more than 33 million people had AIDS in 2008. But the report did have some good news. Many of those with HIV/AIDS are living longer because of the increasing availability of life-saving drugs. Also, the rate of the new infections has slowed in some of the worst-hit areas, including sub-Saharan Africa. As the U.S. Senate debates health care reform, faith-based groups are continuing to lobby on a host of issues, from funding for abortion services to coverage for immigrants. One of the major questions is how to provide health insurance for everyone and how to pay for it. Health care costs are undeniably high across the board. Lucky Severson took a look at the situation, especially for the elderly in Miami, Florida.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Do you know how old you are?
Yeah.
How old are you? How old are you? You are 90.
Not long ago, Dr. Joel Strom and his wife Jane were so convinced that Jane's father was close to death, notwithstanding the attention he was receiving from 10 specialists, they put him in a hospice, and then he got better.
Part of it was that he had one person who took care of him. They cut out all the referrals because they didn't expect him to live long, and they cut out all the medicines.
Dr. Strom is a cardiologist and a professor at the University of South Florida Medical School. Like every doctor we spoke with, Strom is fed up with the healthcare system.
It's not a broken system. There is no system. Medical care is haphazard. Medical care is disorganized. There are pockets of superb care. There are pockets of very mediocre care.
If Medicare costs are any measure, Miami-Dade County should have the best senior care in the country. The federal health program spends over $16,000 a year per patient. That's about double the 2006 national average. Brian Keeley is the CEO of Baptist Health South Florida, the largest nonprofit health care system in that part of the state. He says huge Medicare costs do not translate to better health care.
We know that more can be injurious to people, and more health care services, more aggressively providing those services, can result in lower levels of care.
He says there are several factors that bloat health care costs in the Miami area.
There's a huge imbalance between the number of specialists and primary care physicians, and we have such a high percentage of specialists down over here, they utilize resources more and technology more.
Dr. Strom, a specialist himself, says one reason there is such a shortage of primary care physicians is that Medicare doesn't reimburse them enough for patient visits.
If you spend a lot of time with a patient, you'll starve to death as a physician because you will only get paid for a certain amount of time. In fact, a lot of physicians will actually steer patients to their offices to have tests performed because they collect both the professional component, and if they own the equipment, the technical component.
Dr. Gloria Weinberg is a geriatrician and chair of the Department of Medicine at Mount Sinai Hospital in Miami Beach.
Hello.
She says when young doctors fresh out of medical school and burdened with school loans discover how much less a primary physician earns, they choose a specialty where they can make more money.
If you look at the reimbursement, you're going to come away after paying expenses, if you're lucky, with $40 or $50 an hour. That's not going to help the youngsters go into a field of medicine and pay off loans and do everything else that needs to be done.
Here in Miami, a typical senior citizen will see a doctor 106 times during the last 2 years of their lives. Not just one doctor, several specialists who will then prescribe a battery of expensive tests and procedures, MRIs, ultrasounds, CAT scans, and an astonishing assortment of drugs.
Breathe with your mouth open.
It's because that's the kind of care patients around here often demand. Dr. Weinberg.
Patients are very sophisticated. They come in, they say, I have a headache. You take a headache history. They're not satisfied if you say, you don't need a scan. They want a scan. If you're pushed and you're suspicious enough and perhaps you suggest a CT, which is less expensive than an MR, some of them will come to you and say, I want an MR. I hear it's more sensitive. We've had patients in our center tell us, if you don't do what I'm asking, I'm going to sue you.
The threat of lawsuits forced many doctors to practice defensive medicine, ordering more tests and procedures to protect themselves from being sued. Healthcare professionals here cited malpractice suits as another factor behind spiraling costs. And Medicare fraud in South Florida, particularly in the home healthcare industry, has been described as rampant.
The Miami Herald reported about a month ago that the FBI and CMS indicated that fraud was about $2.5 billion per year in Miami-Dade County. That in and of itself is a huge, huge difference comparing our cost structure to the rest of the country.
About 50 million Americans are uninsured, and that includes 30% of the population around Miami. Many of that number are undocumented and in the U.S. illegally. Whatever their status, most who need care end up in a hospital emergency room where, by law, they cannot be refused treatment.
It's our ethical responsibility to treat that patient as we would any other. That patient can go down the path of having a cardiac catheterization, ultimately having a pacemaker, a defibrillator at $30,000, ongoing medical care, and then we face the problem when we discharge the patient. Where does the patient get the follow-up care? And the hospital doesn't get reimbursed for it.
Perhaps the biggest chunk of Medicare expenditures, something like 30%, goes to end-of-life care for aging Americans. Professor Anita Cava directs the University of Miami Business Ethics Program. She says Americans need to rethink the way we look at end-of-life medical care.
I think we in the United States really need to consider our relationship with end of life and to realize that it's a natural process and that perhaps ending life in a more humane and comfortable way at home with family rather than trying to prolong it for another day or week or month is perhaps the best way to go.
Dr. Weinberg says the decisions about the ethics of distributive justice for society as a whole are often much more difficult when the doctor is meeting with the patient one-on-one.
The healthcare dollars, an inordinate amount, go to taking care of people in the last 6 months of their lives. But how do you know when those last 6 months are? You have a person who's worked all their life, paid taxes, done very well, and now they're 80. And they have a heart attack. That may be the person who lives 10 or 15 more years. Are we going to say no just because of age? That's a very, very slippery slope.
There is a huge ethical discussion about who should make these end-of-life decisions, the patient, the family, doctors, the government. Brian Keeley says some decisions are easier to make. For instance, Medicare should only reimburse for treatments and drugs that are known to work.
It ought to be evidence-based. If something is proven not to work, I don't think the federal government ought to be paying for it. I don't think anybody ought to be paying for it, except for the private patient.
Dr. Weinberg says too many patients receive expensive treatments and surgery in their final years that very likely won't prolong their life.
So if you have an Alzheimer patient who your own belief may be, it's time to let this person go naturally, and the family is telling you, I'm the surrogate and I'm insisting that a feeding tube be put in, you cannot make the decision not to put the feeding tube on your own, even though you think it's futile care, at least in the state of Florida.
Other parts of the country where people plan for end-of-life care with the use of hospices and palliative care and what have you, down here there's less usage for that. So people go to die in the hospitals.
Everyone seems to agree that health care reform is urgently needed and that health care should be a right and not a privilege, and that it should extend to everyone. They also agree that South Florida is a good place to start. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Miami.
Since that story first aired in July, Dr. Joel Strom's father-in-law, Al Golan, passed away. Archbishop of Canterbury Rowan Williams says he came away from a meeting at the Vatican encouraged about Anglican relations with the Roman Catholic Church. Williams and Pope Benedict XVI discussed ecumenical relationships during a 20-minute-long private meeting last weekend. Tensions had escalated after the Vatican announced a new plan to make it easier for disaffected Anglicans to become Catholics. But Williams said he doesn't see that as, quote, a dawn raid against the worldwide Anglican Communion. In the early days of Christianity, monks hand-copied the Bible. Earlier this year, the Christian publishing company Zondervan sponsored its own version of that, traveling across the country and getting more than 31,000 Americans to copy the Bible by hand, one verse at a time. The effort produced two handwritten Bibles, and one of those was auctioned on eBay this week. It was sold for $15,407.53. The money will go to a ministry that translates and distributes Bibles around the world. On our calendar, this weekend, Muslims are celebrating Eid al-Adha, the Festival of Sacrifice. According to Islamic tradition, Muslims slaughter animals to commemorate the Prophet Abraham's willingness to sacrifice his son. The three-day holiday comes at the end of the annual Hajj, when an estimated 2 million Muslims honored their Islamic obligation to, at least once in their lifetime, make the pilgrimage to Mecca. And for most Christians, the Advent season begins this weekend. It's the month-long period of spiritual reflection and preparation leading up to Christmas. Finally, we have a profile of gospel singer Wintley Phipps. He's been performing for more than 30 years, and he's sung for every president since Ronald Reagan. He got rave reviews when he sang at President Obama's inaugural prayer service this past January. Phipps says hope and grace, even amazing grace, have been the hallmarks of his career. He doesn't do a lot of interviews, but he sat down with me earlier this year.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound.
Grammy-nominated gospel singer Wintley Phipps is a familiar voice at big national events. At President Barack Obama's national prayer service following his inauguration, Phipps' rendition of Amazing Grace brought the entire National Cathedral audience, including the new President and First Lady, to their feet. But he says it's just as meaningful to him when he sings in places like prisons.
There is a sense that you're giving hope to people who really need it.
For Phipps, who's also a Seventh-day Adventist pastor, music is a ministry, and he says one of the deepest expressions of his Christian faith.
Music is almost, to me, an echo of the sounds of the divine world. And when you hear these sounds, it stirs something deeply spiritual within you. Music also is the most powerful way of impressing the human mind with hope.
Hope has been a hallmark not only of Phipps' musical career, but in his charitable efforts as well. In 1998, Phipps founded the Dream Academy, a national nonprofit for at-risk kids. Born in Trinidad, he says hope was crucial in overcoming his own at-risk childhood.
I was born to a troubled home. I used to get away from my parents' troubles. I had a little red tricycle. And I'd go in the backyard of my house, and I would turn the tricycle on its side and use one of the backside wheels as a steering wheel. And I would sit there for hours, and I would dream that I was flying to faraway places in the world and meeting important people. And I was 6, 7 years old. And then I wanted to be like Tom Jones. I'd go around the house singing, "It's not unusual to be loved." I just want to be Tom, but it was missing to me.
Despite a difficult family life, Phipps says his mother always prayed for him and told him that God had a special plan for his life. As a teenager, Phipps embraced her faith as his own.
At the age of 16, God walked into my life and said, I've seen your dreams. Give me your dreams, and I'll let you see what I've been dreaming for you.
He attended an historically black Seventh-day Adventist college in Alabama, where he met Linda, now his wife of 32 years. Then, Phipps says, God began providing opportunities for him to sing in national venues, such as a 1984 appearance on Saturday Night Live with Jesse Jackson. He came to the attention of Billy Graham's team and became a frequent performer at the Evangelist Crusades.
Talk about a child that do love Jesus.
Phipps also became a favorite in Washington. He's sung for every president since Ronald Reagan.
I've never had a manager or never had an agent, and yet some of the most wonderful moments that a singer could ever dream of have happened to me, and I believe it's providential.
The gospel story, I've been traveling.
The idea for the Dream Academy came after he got involved with a prison ministry.
I did not know that so many young men in prison looked like my sons. And when I saw it, I was shaken. One of every three young black men in America between the ages of 18 and 30 are in prison today or supervised by the court system, either on probation or parole.
Phipps then learned that 60% of the young people who end up in prison are the children of prisoners. He wanted to break the cycle of intergenerational incarceration. The Dream Academy offers after-school mentoring and interactive academic tutoring to children of prisoners and kids falling behind at school.
One of the most exciting things that can ever happen in a child's life is to know that, you mean, God thinks about me or God dreams about me, and he's got a dream for my life. And when you catch a little glimpse of what that dream is, wow, it changes everything.
Phipps has enlisted the support of some of his famous connections for the project. One of his biggest benefactors is his longtime friend, Oprah Winfrey. The lesson of faith, he says, is that things aren't always as they seem, and that hardship can be overcome. In these uncertain economic times, he's released a new music DVD called No Need to Fear.
No need to fear.
It's a theme he finds throughout the old spirituals that he often performs.
The Negro spiritual teaches us that you're going to come up rough sides of mountains and you're going to have difficulties. But faith gives you that ability to weather any storm.
Looked over Jordan, and what did I see?
It's the core theme as well for the song that has become his signature, Amazing Grace. He finds great spiritual lessons in the history of the song.
A lot of people don't realize that just about all Negro spirituals are written on the black notes of the piano. And they just keep recurring. Probably the most famous white spiritual that's built on this slave scale was written by a man by the name of John Newton, who before he became a Christian used to be the captain of a slave ship, and many believe heard this melody that sounds very much like a West African sorrows chant. Haunting, haunting, plaintive quality to it that reaches past your arrogance, past your pride, and it speaks to that part of you that's in bondage. And we feel it. We feel it. It's just one of the most amazing melodies in all of human history.
To sing God's praise.
Another lesson, he says, on how hope always triumphs. I'm Kim Lawton in Vero Beach, Florida.
That's our program for now. I'm Kim Lawton. There's much more on our website, including more from Wintley Phipps. You can comment on all of our stories and share them. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, Phipps and Amazing Grace.
But now I see.